Hello.
And welcome back to This Is Not
a History
Lecture.
Oh, it's, you know, it's another week.
It's
another week. And
1 week and three episodes that we are recording.
Yeah,
this week.
This is our first of three that we're, well, this one is pretty normal on our recording schedule, but we're recording two pre-records because I'm out of town for a wedding next weekend and Kat's out of town for Thanksgiving the weekend after that. Mm-hmm. And then we're going to panic and hope that we're both back here in time to record for
if
the
not,
one after that.
If not, we do know that our mics work over Zoom.
We will have alternative plans.
I just got to remember to pack my mic.
Bring it.
Case.
Yeah.
Right. So but, Sharpie on my arm.
Yeah. So we're, it's, what is it? November 3rd.
Mm-hmm.
So just so y'all know, there is, as we talked about last episode, hold on. Let's finish the intro off and then let's get into that.
Yeah, it's episode 144. Mm-hmm. We are bringing you the part two of our
part
witches.
Two. And we, this one, Kat, yours is probably pretty like kind of self-contained, but if you want context for what Kat's talking about today, and then you'll will probably need to know and listen to my half from yesterday. So we what from yesterday from last episode. So we would very much encourage you to listen to that to find out why.
This is not a history lecture with Kat and Kaylee.
Okay. A big reason why we wanted to mention that we were pre-recording is because, as we talked about in the last episode, and as most of you probably are aware of, there is essentially an act of genocide happening in Gaza right now, committed against the Palestinian people that live in the Gaza Strip and perpetrated by the Israeli government and the IDF. There have been some, since we recorded last, some really, really, just outright war crimes that have happened. There was a refugee camp that was one of the most, Gaza is already the most populated, condensedly populated, as I was saying, Gaza is already one of the most densely populated places on Earth, and in Gaza there is a refugee camp that is the most densely populated place on Earth. And unfortunately, that was bombed a few days ago, and then they bombed it again. And I haven't seen a recent death toll, but I saw somewhere that injured was around 20,000, and I can't imagine that people dead are anything less than 10,000. They today bombed, a fleet of ambulances leaving a hospital. And it's becoming more and more obvious. I mean, it's always been obvious, but this is an extermination event, or attempt. And it's one that unfortunately a lot of Western governments are complicit in because of stupid, asinine political reasons about wanting to have a foothold in the Middle East. So as we talked about last episode, it's really important to not look away from this. It's really important to not be overwhelmed. I mean, it is overwhelming and it's hard not to do that. But the most important thing is that we look and watch and acknowledge what's happening, because this is how genocides happen, is they happen in essentially isolation.
They happen when people look away.
They happen when people look away. Yeah. Some action steps you can take are calling your representative if you're an American. I'm sure that there are similar systems set up in other Western governments, at least. And I actually saw a trick that if you call after business hours, you can just leave a message. So if you have like phone anxiety, that is a good strategy for you. And from what I've heard, they just kind of keep a running tally on how many calls they receive on a certain issue. So it doesn't have to be any sort of impassioned speech. Of course, you can leave one if you'd like to, but it can be just as simple as I'm calling in regards to the situation in Gaza. I am asking for an immediate ceasefire, or I am asking for my representatives to call for an immediate ceasefire. There are a lot of web pages and apps and resources that can help you guide you through those kinds of things that you can do, because one of our most important tools that we have in this is our voice. Another thing is that there are some very active boycotts going on against McDonald's and Starbucks specifically. And there's a third one, Disney.
There's a whole list you can find.
There is a whole list, but from what I've seen is most people are like, okay, too many targets is hard to do,
right?
So we need to focus on,
and especially in America. Mm-hmm. Like, if we're being honest, our politicians only care about money.
Money.
So you have to speak their language. And mm-hmm. so boycotting seems, you know, useless sometimes. You're like, I'm mm-hmm. one person. What's my $6 Starbucks? But it does make a difference.
It does make a difference.
It's proven to make a difference. Mm-hmm. It has throughout history. Mm-hmm. And even if, you know, McDonald's isn't actively like, oh, I am sending money to the IDF. Like, mm-hmm. their support means something right. to politicians. It means
exactly.
something to people. And
exactly.
you kind of got to hit them where it hurts. And in America, that's the bank.
Yeah. So another big one with Starbucks is, they're essentially using like money in the Starbucks app as like a de facto bank.
Oh, I thought you were going to talk about them suing their union.
Well, yeah, that is. So if you're curious as to why Starbucks specifically, Starbucks union, their union came out in support of Palestine, and Starbucks, the company, sued them for supporting Palestine. So pretty egregious, thing to do, to not only be complicit in a genocide, but to actively mm-hmm. sue your union mm-hmm. for speaking out against one.
Yeah. And I do want to note too, there's been a really kind of scary rise in hate crimes against mm-hmm. Jewish individuals right mm-hmm. now. And I would like to note that just like I don't want to be lumped in with every American, mm-hmm. it is important to remember that a government does not always represent the people mm-hmm. and that Jewish does not inherently mean
no.
anything as far and as fact, nationality and belief.
Yes, there are a lot of Jewish people who are actively trying to
protest groups, yeah.
and make this stop. What is the, let me find, there's like one main organization I've seen for Jewish people that are anti-
Yeah, there's uh-huh. quite a few, and I just want to make that known because the worst thing you can do is create more hate crimes in reaction to hate crimes.
Yeah.
Because it's going mm-hmm. to, it's just really hard to, like, mm-hmm. it is throwing gasoline onto a fire.
Yes.
When because, like, there's a yeah. long history, too, of anti-Semitism and the, yeah. like, so I just want to, like...
Yeah.
Like, however scared you are and angry at, like, IDF or the Israeli government, that is not all Jewish people.
No. And that's also remembering, too, that there's also been a rise in hate crimes against Muslim
yes,
people.
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, not every activist mm-hmm. group supports everyone. And I know that's what makes this so muddled and hard to understand and follow. But there is zero reason mm-hmm. ever to be bombing mm-hmm. refugee camps.
There is zero reason to be bombing civilians, period.
Yes, yes, yes.
I don't
Especially
care.
That. I just mean on the
yeah,
tail
no,
of
I know.
What happened this
no,
week.
No, I know. I don't care. There could be 10,000 Hamas soldiers hiding in a bunker with 5 civilians.
It's still not okay
it's
to just
still
bomb
not okay
it indiscriminately.
To bomb civilians indiscriminately. And that was the excuse. There was one Hamas, I think, like, leader in this refugee camp, and that's why they bombed it. And then they're like, oops, we don't even know if we got him. Sorry.
Yeah.
And it's egregious. Piers fucking Morgan came out today and said that he officially said that
do,
he does
do you know
not
how
support
bad it has to be
for Piers Morgan to
Which is interesting to see yeah. so many like politicians and political people mm-hmm. coming against this when our mm-hmm. government is still like blindly not addressing.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
in fact, they are actively encouraging the situation because yeah. they are approving yeah. $14 billion in aid uh-huh. to Israel mm-hmm. for them to bomb them some more.
Yeah.
And it's infuriating to watch. And it's so obviously clear. I mean, it's been clear for a long time now, but it's so starkly and obviously clear that in the West, in America especially, our government is not a voice of the people.
It's not. And that's in likewise mm-hmm. to everything else going on. Like, IDF is not a voice of all Jewish people.
No.
And that's like, I don't want yeah. people across the, like in a European nation right now looking at America and thinking all Americans support Israel and the mm-hmm. IDF because their government is support. Like, it's so hard to, like, deal with no. absolutes.
Yeah. No, and to me, in my mind, I mean, I know a lot of people kind of conflate the two, but to me, in my mind, those are two entirely different, because I know my right. relationship with my government.
Right.
And I know that
a government usually does not represent its people.
Yeah, yeah.
If we're being frank about it. It's very rare.
Yeah. So it's... What's happening is appalling and disgusting and horrifying and egregious and literally a crime against humanity. And mm-hmm. babies are dying. Children account for about half of the victims of these bombings. And not that adult lives don't matter either, but, you know, it's it is astonishing to me that people are still denying that this is happening.
Yeah. And you know, when we talk about, you know, remember this, all those things, mm-hmm. there's so very few absolutes, but the absolute at the end of the day is our ethical compass, and that's what makes humans mm-hmm. humans. And mm-hmm. our definite, our 100% irrefutable facts need to mm-hmm. actually come from our ability to mm-hmm. empathize with each other and mm-hmm. value
yeah
human life. And yeah. that's for yeah. somehow is in question by a lot of mm-hmm. governments right now.
Also, no one gets like a religious ethnostate. I thought we established that a while ago. And this is why. no one gets to have a religious ethnostate. Like, it's bad.
A radical it thought.
Two bad things. It's rough. It's really, really, really rough. And yeah.
It's just something that, you know, yeah. to always have your eye on and understand mm-hmm. what's going on. And that's why we've been talking about it the past few weeks, is we want yeah. to give you,
yeah,
you know, yeah. to make sure that, do our part to make sure that people aren't just turning away from it, that yeah. it's still happening.
That's a great way to put it. It's hard to watch, and it's hard to not look away. But
it's harder to do that like alone. And I think mm-hmm. that's also like coming in here and having you sit across mm-hmm. from me, whether someone's listening to us over the mic or it's sitting across from someone. Like, it is easier to process these things
yeah.
when you have someone with you.
Yeah.
So if this is your one chance that you have listening to mm-hmm. us talk about it to process this information. Mm-hmm. Be yeah. our guest. Like, that's part please, of why we talk about please. This stuff is
yeah.
it's hard to like
it's hard
to do this stuff yeah. alone.
It is. And it's hard to you do in times like this, you feel helpless and you do what you can, but it still doesn't feel like enough because yeah. people are still dying. And it yeah. I mean, there's no positive in this situation.
No, none at all.
But it's important that we talk about it.
Yeah.
And it's important that we do what we can. And
that's what we're doing.
And that's what we're doing. So.
So, yeah.
So, yeah.
It's hard just to switch back to history mode after talking about mm-hmm. stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But we're that's kind of our due diligence. We would mm-hmm. not. We would not feel okay not talking about certain things.
Yeah. Yeah. And we, you know, that's been, y'all know, that's been our MO since day one. Mm-hmm. So.
And this honestly has also, like, heightened my own idea of some of my own shortcomings. Because, like, a lot of people have been talking about, like, hey, this has been a humanitarian disaster for the last mm-hmm. couple decades. Why is it just now that people are right. paying attention to it? And,
right.
and, you know, we were talking about, like, there is an active genocide going on right now. Mm-hmm. There have been multiple active genocides going on around mm-hmm. the world. like at all times. There's like eight going on in the last few years. And you know, like this, no one was talking about it because it wasn't their problem. And it makes me realize, like, what is my shortcoming in this?
Right.
You know, what am I going to look back on in a few years and be like, wow, I should have been talking about this way sooner. I should have been thinking harder about it, evaluating it and understanding it sooner. And it makes me really like realize like the stakes of not paying more attention.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And like you said, like people count on us not talking about these things to allow them to continue to happen.
Yeah.
I think Israel is clearly panicking. And when I say Israel, I mean the government. That there are so many people panicking because they are outright targeting journalists, and not only journalists, but their families. Yeah. Which is just, I don't think
also
technically,
a war crime.
Is
I
that
think
a war crime? Even if it's not, it's generally frowned upon.
I think there is I think it's a more recent statute, but I think there is something that protects freedom of press within.
That makes sense.
Area, like,
Yeah. So
I need to look into that, but yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah. Yeah. That's going on, and
well, like we said, we're pre-recording a little bit, so we'll talk about it as much as we're updated with it.
And the scariest part is that while the two or three weeks that we are gone, odds are that something very bad is going to happen.
I know. And it could be a much, much, much worse situation.
Which is hard to fathom this getting worse.
I know.
But it can.
So
hang in there. And while in, you know, our next couple episodes, while we're not able to update live time week by week, we recommend that you stay listening to things like Al Jazeera.
Primary sources are always, especially in this situation, always, because there is so much kind of straight up propaganda around what's happening here.
Like the IDF making videos that are spoken in English, which in itself should say a lot about who their target audience actually is.
During a time when they wiped the internet out for the whole Gaza Strip, issuing a warning to Gaza. So just pay attention.
We won't be here to update you live time for a little bit, so just keep that in mind. Hopefully when we come back,
something
has been done.
Because I can't imagine another 3 weeks of this. It's already been.
So, I guess we got to cut over to what people tuned in for. Which, happy-go-lucky here today, as we said before, I will be jumping right back in with Salem. The history of specifically the Salem witch trials. Cal mentioned it that before, you know, if you want background, I do recommend it, actually going into the background and listening to both of our episode if you haven't, because I do mention a little bit of the
lead-up. I mean, history is context, so...
Yeah. And there is a lot of context leading up to Salem and the Americas in general that kind of... pardon my... terrible statement here. It kind of creates this crucible in which the Salem witch trials happen.
Nice.
Thank you. I was not even intending that. That's just came to me. For those of you who did not have to take eighth grade English in a public school in America, the Crucible is Arthur Miller's play about the Salem witch trials. Anyway, so the summary here. If you don't happen to know what the Salem witch trials are, it's a famous batch of witch trials that began in the spring of 1692 when a group of young girls who were supposedly possessed by the devil and attacked by people practicing witchcraft. It required a special court to hear all these cases and came out with a bunch of official accusations against witches, ultimately creating this hysteria and paranoia around what would become known as the Salem witch trials. Many people would be accused, others would be convicted, and quite a few would be murdered for it. I would also like to note that as mentioned in the last week's episode, the witch hunts in Europe greatly affected how they happened in America because, you know, someone coming from Spain to America is not going to have the same reaction to the accusation of witches that someone from Germany is going to have to the accusation of witches.
Yeah. There's also a delay there.
So I just want to keep that in mind as we jump into this because the background on Salem is going to largely play a role and contribute to why Salem became kind of the case study of the worst of the witch trials. I would also like to think, I like to do this when there's one source that really knocks it out of the park.
I love when there's one solid source. It's my favorite.
And this one was not Britannica or World Encyclopedia. This one. Smithsonian. We love it.
Yes.
We love it. Thank you, Smithsonian Magazine. They had a really cool article that also I just felt did a good job of considering a lot of rounded history in it. But yes, so let's jump back to Salem, Massachusetts in 1692. 200 years after 1492 when Columbus sailed the ocean blue. So that tells you a little bit, like I say it jokingly, but also that tells you a little bit. Yeah. Like 200 years, this land's been discovered. Uh-huh. Colonizers have started to commit genocide already in many ways against the indigenous people. Like, there's a lot of uncertainty, and there is also this idea in place already about the rights, mm-hmm. the almost religious rights of these people to come here and take this land and do all this stuff. So that's just an important part. It's been a couple hundred years since we first see Europeans set foot here.
Yeah.
And specifically Salem itself, we're going to, you know, if we're in 1692, we're going to go back about 70 years before that. That's when the first settlers really step foot in this area. They landed first at, I'm going to mispronounce this and I apologize, Naumkeag. It's an indigenous name.
Okay.
In 1626.
It sounded like Swedish to me. And I was
it almost did the way I said it. And that's why I was not sure. It's spelled, it might be Naumkeag or Keag or something. I'm not sure how it's pronounced. I tried to Google this one and I really struggled. But yes, they landed there in 1626. It was obviously inhabited by indigenous people, and it was actually pretty significant to them being on the edge of the water, which we know tends to be very good land and necessary land. These colonizers were establishing an outpost for the Massachusetts Bay Colony.
Mm-hmm.
This is a largely Puritan group who were hoping to get kind of, as the name suggests, purify Roman Catholic influence from the Church of England and build themselves this sort of perfect society, or city of peace would be the technical translation, because it is named Jerusalem. Oh. And that is where we get the name Salem.
Oh.
It is named after Jerusalem, I should say. So it becomes Salem, City of Peace.
Oh, I did not know that.
Okay. It's very ironic considering what would happen over the next few decades.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. But with that development of Massachusetts Bay Colony and the outpost, with some wealth coming in from trade, but also other people who are, you know, working the land. We talked about this in the Americas. We have an upstart of society. Or, well, there was already society here with the indigenous people, but we have a colonizers starting their society, which means a couple of things. The mentality here is very complex. You have people who are coming to this new world with hope. They think that it is a land of opportunity. And yes, hard work will be there, but they come here for a better life. And they often feel like they are entitled to it. But what does that come with? Did all of them expect to do as much hardy work as they were going to have to? Did some of them resent that when they got there, there were already established families who were making money while they had to work the land? Was, you know, did everyone expect to make their million here and then didn't? You know, what does that tension between class look like as well? And this is not a, oh, my grandfather has owned this land for the last 500 years, therefore I am indisputably the owner of it.
Like, indubitably.
Indubitably.
I can't even say that word.
Indubitably. So there's a lot of that, like, class imbalance there of people unsure of what their status is. Mm-hmm. It's mercurial. You have space to move up, but also that fear that you could be demoted in society pretty easily. Mm-hmm. You could lose everything pretty easily. And that puts a lot of strain between Salem and what is known as Salem Village at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So Salem Village, which is now called Danvers, was a much more rural. Oh, I have so much trouble with that word. It's like cotton or alcohol. It's a much more rural area. It's approximately 10 miles inland from the water, and it tended to be a lot more like a kind of poorer farming community that had about 500 people in it at this point. And there's two main families there.
Mm-hmm.
Very dramatic. have a great storybook rivalry going on.
Is this like Romeo and Juliet kind of situation?
Kind of. It's the Porter's family who received a lot of benefits from being kind of from the wealthier Bayside town, and the Putnams, which family thought that, you know, this isn't Salem proper, so we should have more independence. And we should have, you know, be able to do what we want. So, you know, Porters are kind of benefiting from this big, they don't want to separate completely because they're benefiting from their relationship with town proper, and Putnams are not. This conflict between the two families does lead to a good bit of like land disputes and other skirmishes. There's some like litigations against each other, muddling the waters, creating tension among them essentially. And that's just important to note. Salem Town proper, which is the one actually on the water, seemed to be a little bit more prolific and prosperous. It was more commerce oriented because it was right on that port of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, and they have a lot more access to wealth, trade, et cetera, et cetera. It's also important to note that there is some tension over the charter of Salem or the Massachusetts Bay Colony at this point, because in the 1690s.
I know, it's so bad, especially when it's a 9
and a 6, like, and they just the flip in your
but not that 90s.
No, not that one. The colonists,
it's like, wait, isn't in Parks and Rec there that joke where it's like dress like the 90s and April comes in like pilgrim clothes?
Oh, they do it for it's yeah. What is that? I thought you meant it is. That's a good episode too. But yes, because in the 1690s, the colonists had been pushing back against the British laws, and their charter was actually revoked by governing authorities. And so the government didn't really have like technical political control over the area because the charter had been revoked. And it left it with this really awkward system where no one really knows what's going on, who has the authority, et cetera, et cetera. And in 1691, King William and Queen Mary have given them the charter back, which meant that their autonomy... Well, like, okay. In 1691, King William and Queen Mary, that's the year they reinstate the charter. Or maybe they created the original, which later got reneged. But I don't do well with legal stuff. It confuses me. either way.
Honestly, neither did they at this point.
They did not. No. And as we say in history, sometimes it's not memorizing the exact fact. It's understanding the implications.
Yeah. What does it mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The charter isn't so much the important part. It's the fact that this charter and its state of flux really threatens the autonomy of the Puritan colony to stand on their own and exert religious dominance versus political dominance.
Gotcha.
That's what's really important about this, is that the Puritans are like, do we have power? Can we say this? Can we do this? I don't know. And it also comes down to extreme weather conditions creating tension. It was some really hot summers and some really nasty winters. Colonizers encroaching on indigenous lands that the indigenous people were obviously like, no. Stay back. Mm-hmm. We will attack you if you try to attack us. Mm-hmm. Smallpox outbreaks as well. So you kind of get all the tensions, everything that could possibly go wrong here, whether it be socio-political, economic, all of it is happening.
Yeah.
The boundary for Salem itself is about 70 square miles by the end of the 1600s. So we're dealing with a pretty big space and a lot of tensions within it. And let's skip to the names. Let's start telling a story. Let's craft the story.
Yeah, here we go.
In the small, more rural Salem village.
That was good. That was solid.
Thank you. we pan over.
Okay. Yeah.
To
set the scene. Set the scene. A quaint colonizing village. Yes.
We cut to the buckled boots of Reverend Samuel Parris striding down the
street. The gold buckle glinted on the shoe of the colonizer.
As he passes, we don't get a good glimpse of his face yet, but the ladies on the side of the street are whispering to each other. The drama about how this small rural town has gotten an ordained reverend, but not one that everyone seems to agree with.
Oh, the drama.
It turns out, as the gossip spreads, we pan to another group of girls whispering behind their hands, that the Putnams of the small rural town had a say in getting Reverend Samuel Parris ordained.
That is drama.
It is.
Oh my god, that is drama.
end, as he strides across the street with Bible in hand, we hear a voiceover telling us, ever so discreetly, in the voice probably of Julie Andrews in a Bridgerton-esque, you know, display, that this man, Reverend Samuel Parris, in fact, had been a merchant from Boston and hadn't even finished his theological degree at what used to be Harvard College before being ordained as a reverend and placed in Salem Village.
The scandal!
The scandal.
Oh my god, this is juicy. Okay.
Mm-hmm. He had never actually graduated nor gotten the qualifications to really hold a position of such power.
Wow.
As we find as he strides along the street, ignoring the whispers that plague him all the way. Can you tell I play way too much D&D?
D&D Salem? Question mark?
Oh, that would be such a cool...
Oh!
A little irreverent, maybe, and sacrilegious, but hey,
what,
I can...
What D&D that's campaign true. Is
that's
it?
True. Actually, I can guarantee there's probably like a million like Patreon Salem witch settings.
Oh, for sure.
But yes, putting aside my theatrics, that is very much the case.
Yeah. I did really enjoy the picture you were painting there.
Thank you.
Well done. Well
thank
done.
You.
Brava.
Thank you. But yes, Reverend Samuel Parris did not, you know, totally have the qualifications mm-hmm. in many people's eyes to do what mm-hmm. they're doing. And it's not like these days where you have like a synod or a diocese to like mm-hmm. approve like this person has the qualifications. I have done their background check, et cetera, et cetera. We mm-hmm. don't have that. But you still need the court of public opinion on your side. Mm-hmm. And this man did not have everyone's favor. To Salem, he had also brought a lot of his family, namely 3 children, a niece, a wife, and 2 enslaved people from where he used to trade in Barbados. Historians also don't completely agree on what the relationship of the 2 enslaved people were, or their origins. They may have been from Barbados. I saw one source that said they might have been indigenous to the Caribbean or mm-hmm. Caribbean, depending on which part of Pirates of the Caribbean you are watching. but... regardless, this man, Reverend Parris, is now in charge of the religious guidance of the entire village. Not only does he have doubts because he hasn't fulfilled his complete degree requirements, but within the early time of him taking this contract, he kind of tries to renegotiate it to get paid more and to receive more benefits, almost. It's not health insurance exactly, but he wants to try to get ownership of the parsonage itself, which is not something that's really everyone's on board
yeah.
with. Like, that's also not a normal ask.
Isn't that, yeah, that's like owned by the church, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and you just live
it's
in
like
it.
A community.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you, yeah, you live yeah. there and you go wherever.
Right. Yeah.
You know, I'm not exactly sure how the Puritans do it versus like modern religions and
yeah.
stuff, but it is an odd ask. And he asks it pretty early in his tenure or in his time here at
this
in
guy
this
just
community.
Seems like he's got a lot of audacity.
He does. He has yeah. a lot of audacity. I mean, yeah. dare I say a lot of.
Caucasity?
Yeah, I was yeah. gonna say caucasity. I love a good slang. But even the Puritans, not even the Puritans, but I should note that the Puritans who are based around trying to remove what they perceive to be corruption from the church, a lot of them, this doesn't sit well. This mm-hmm. feels greedy. Mm-hmm. And Puritans are kind of famously not about that. So
fair enough. Yeah.
That plus his whole degree thing, it creates a lot of doubt.
I can see that.
Some people also didn't agree with his theology, namely his Orthodox Puritan practice of removing essentially close communion. If you attend church regularly, even now, or you have a lot of experience with communion, you'll know that this is still a big conversation and sometimes a very contentious issue, depending on what church body you are part of. The practice I grew up with was actually, I grew up LCMS Lutheran. Closed communion is the mm-hmm. norm for those churches. But it varies and it has a lot of implications. Closed communion is essentially when you remove everyone who is not like a part of your church, a member of
okay.
your church for communion. It's
gotcha.
Not open to the public.
Gotcha.
A lot of churches have their different reasons.
Mm-hmm.
The most common one being that it is a very sacred thing to people who practice and take communion.
Mm-hmm.
So they want to ensure that the people they are giving communion to fully understand the impact of it and are either confirmed or baptized or have an understanding of what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of churches open and offer offer it openly. Mm-hmm. Some tell you to consult the pastor before you take it, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But at this time, Reverend Paris was regularly forcing people to leave before communion that were not members of that congregation. So he was essentially practicing a close communion, and it created two factions, essentially, in the congregation. Those who believed in close communion and those that didn't. And therefore, it seemed that this often aligned with just who does like Reverend Paris and who doesn't like mm-hmm. Reverend Paris. And all this is important because he's got a daughter named Elizabeth.
Mm-hmm.
A 9-year-old girl. And he's also got a niece named Abigail Williams, an 11-year-old girl.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't necessarily fit the status quo, but it is very possible that the religious implications of what he was doing and the people that didn't disagree with him or mm-hmm. did disagree with him caused some of the hysteria and paranoia or belief or disbelief of his daughter and niece. Because these two girls are going to be the first to experience what kind of became known as like the fits that the witchcraft, the recipients of the witchcraft.
Right. They were being the ones tormented.
Yes. They were cursed. Yes. There's some contortions and screaming and fits, which the local Dr. William Griggs diagnosed as bewitchment. These episodes start appearing in January of 1692. And I would like to clarify, medicine in this time, it could very well be like he genuinely believed in bewitchment as a valid medical thing. Or he may have just been like, I don't know what this is, therefore it must be bewitchment. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to sound stupid and not know what I'm not be able to give him a diagnosis, et cetera, et cetera.
I'm doubling down.
Yeah. And it's also very much true that historians aren't in consensus about what actually happened to these girls. There has been a big popular theory in the last few years that I kind of throw around a lot because to me it makes, like, it's possible. Do I believe it is the cause of everything? No, but we've thrown it around on this podcast before as like a possibility. Mm-hmm. That there was a fungus in the food supply.
Oh, yeah.
That there was something physical that people were ingesting that caused this. But it's very possible. We'll get into those in a second. It's also possible that there was some other illness. Smallpox was going around a lot right now. We don't have perfect, you know, microbiology at this time to analysis, like what strains of what illnesses were around and apparent.
Mm-hmm.
There are also some venereal diseases that can present symptoms like this. It's very up in the air without our ability to literally like take a blood sample now and know.
Right.
But it's important to remember that either way, these two girls that first exhibit these symptoms are girls. They are children. They are not even teenagers yet.
Yeah. And then another thing to consider too is that, like, not to say that they weren't actually sick or anything, but children are very easily influenced.
We talked about it with the satanic panic a couple weeks ago. Yeah.
Yeah. So if a child is told you are sick and it must be a curse from a witch, then they're probably going to be like, I'm cursed by a witch, you know?
And we'll talk about that more in a second because it's the fact that they're children makes them very suggestible.
Uh-huh.
But also, we have to note this when we talk about children, the perception of women and children radically changes between this point and the Victorian times. And when you're talking about like white Eurocentric like cultures, because it's very easy for society, as it benefits them, to change their idea of are children and women frail and need to be protected versus are they vindictive and seductresses and temptresses and Jezebels. Mm-hmm. And so I just want to note that this is a very interesting look at like young children being victims and the community being like, something terrible has happened to our young, innocent children. We must do anything to protect them.
Yeah. And then you'll get into it. We'll talk about it later.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I know there's so much to talk about with this that you can just sit and hash it out forever. But these young girls, whether, again, we also have to account for the fact that this is the Reverend's daughter and niece.
Right.
Were all children innocent and youthful and needed to be protected? Or is it because this is the unquestionably virtuous daughter of the Reverend?
Oh, my stars.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so they're taken into court. They examine the symptoms, et cetera, et cetera. But before we... Okay. Sorry. Let me rewind. Pre-court, all that jazz. They're having these fits. And they are not the only ones. Soon we start to see more young women, many of which were young girls, showing signs of fits, poisoning, sickness, et cetera, et cetera. We do have documents telling us that it was a seizure-like behavior.
Hmm.
I think there's such like an interesting perception in film, like not Blair Witch, The Exorcist, where like your head goes all the way around and everything like that. Because documents say that they were taken to fits and contorting themselves into what was some pretty impressive physical configurations, as far as I can tell. And it also happens with Ann Putnam Jr., who's a 12-year-old that exhibits similar things, who was friends with Abigail and Elizabeth.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're seeing this kind of clustering.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're kind of like, well, proximity-wise, what supernatural things are these girls in in proximity to?
Mm-hmm.
You want to guess at who gets that really interesting, not shockingly, I should just say it, the person who gets... One of the people who gets accused for witchcraft.
Is it a lady from the rival family?
No, it's the enslaved woman.
Oh.
Who is... Uh-huh.
Oh, I didn't even consider
it. Uh-huh. Because my first thought was like, wow, this is totally rival families trying to put each other on the bus. And then I read the name and I was like, you're right. And I remember this in the play that the African, well, not African-American, either Caribbean or... What's the, I guess, identification for Barbadosian?
I don't know.
I don't know what that is, actually.
I'll look that up.
I don't want to misname that. But the one who was either from Barbados or the Caribbean or something like that, Tituba, it gets pointed at.
Right. Okay, which, I do know that name.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. If we're looking at like, oh, well, of course you're going to blame the woman that you've enslaved and brought with your family as the, you know, because what else could be like so exotic and terrifying and unknown and purposefully harmful? So Tituba, I don't know how true this is. And I'm careful of sensationalizing this because I do not want to perpetuate what at the time probably allowed them to point a finger at her and blame her even more for this.
Mm-hmm. Locals call themselves... It's Bajans. So I don't know if that's... Oh, pronounced Bajans.
Bajans.
It says pronounced Bajuns. So Bajans.
Okay, cool. Bajans. Bajans. I like that. That's cool.
Yeah.
It's like Cajun.
Yeah, it is. Bajan. It is like Cajun.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll remember it that way easily. Okay. But yeah. You know when we were kids in elementary school and everyone was making those little origami fortune tellers?
Yeah.
We called ours cootie catchers.
We just called them fortune tellers.
Well, you fold the paper and then you write like the number on the inside. If you've never seen these, Google them.
And it's like pick a color and then you spell out the color. Like
blue, and you do 1, 2, 3, 4.
Yeah.
And then you like flip a thing up and it's like you will get your first kiss, whatever.
Yeah.
If you're really thinking about it, that could be deemed supernatural.
That could
be deemed fortune telling.
It is. That's dabbling in
the occult.
Yes.
And that could very much be the situation with these girls. There are a couple sources that said that they were kind of dealing in fortune telling and may have learned it from Tituba or something like that. Or maybe they saw Tituba practicing what was her religious practices and just thought, this is cool. I'm going to try it.
Or maybe other people knew that Tituba practiced other religious practices and knew that the children were around her.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe the children weren't even doing anything.
Maybe Tituba wasn't even practicing and they were just like, this woman comes from a culture
that
practiced.
Yes, that we consider pagan.
Yeah. And maybe these girls just thought it was cool to fortune tell.
Like, because they're little girls.
Because they're kids.
Yeah.
And we all loved our little fortune telling cootie catchers.
Some things are timeless and part of the human existence.
Yes, they are. But before anything is officially leveled against Tituba, because she is one of three that is first pointed at, with more accusations of witchcraft, the fingers are being pointed. These little girls are being dragged around and coerced into who did this.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, even if they say, oh, it was so-and-so, who's to say the adults weren't like, no, it was so-and-so.
Right.
It was Tituba, wasn't
right.
it? It was, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Tell me it was and I'll give you some candy. Like, we just don't know what was going on behind closed doors. And I really want to stress that because I don't want to sensationalize either the, like, exoticness of other cultures that led to this hysteria. Mm-hmm. But by February 29th, four men and four girls go together to Salem Town proper to make an official complaint against three women. As the girls who had experienced these fits are practically interrogated, they blame three women. These interrogations had begun pretty much the next day after they reported to Salem Town proper. Mm-hmm. The three accused are Sarah Good, who was an unhoused woman that at the time would have been mm-hmm. called a beggar, mm-hmm. who asked for money on the streets. Sarah Osborne, who was an older woman who was quite poor and easy to victimize because older women who, garner a great deal of respect or independence in this time. And Tituba, the enslaved woman who was enslaved by the Paris family. I skipped my notes there. If some of these names, like Sarah Good and everything, are starting to sound familiar, it's because of probably the Crucible. A lot of those are direct, you'll note direct correlations there. But with interrogations, historically we know that most witch interrogations were not particularly kind, nor fair, nor actually...
Interrogations?
And they were not a judicial court proceeding.
No, it was more along the lines of torture.
These women reacted in very different ways. Again, no one here is new to the idea of a witch trial. None of them are probably expecting to be the ones accused of it. Mm-hmm. Sarah Osborne claims that she did nothing at all, as did Sarah Good. And this started on March 1st of 1692. Tituba as well starts off by claiming her innocence and saying that she did nothing wrong. But eventually... And I would like to remind people that this may have been under duress, this may have been under influence, this may have been under a myriad of other factors, does confess mm-hmm. that she had been using some form of witchcraft and had testimony in her confession that she had been asked by the devil himself to do his work mm-hmm. and that she spoke to animals and had there were paranormal signs and things like, she basically said that she was approached by a tall man with white hair who asked her to sign a book, which, assumingly, that's the devil. But mm-hmm. she sealed her fate when she admitted that she signed this book, that she mm-hmm. signed herself over to the devil, and that's, like, the mm-hmm. breaking point. Mm-hmm. And that she had also witnessed the names of the other accused having been written in that book as well. And that there were also, like, that there were, I think... like seven other names that she couldn't mm-hmm. read in the book. Which is interesting that, you know, it's like, oh, I signed my name and I definitely saw those two ladies' names and I saw some other names, but I couldn't read them. Like, it's like, oh, okay, honey.
It's like, oh, now that you mention mm-hmm. it, I did see their names in there.
Yeah.
Is that what that said?
It was really cursive handwriting. I couldn't really decipher it.
I could barely make it out, but now that I think about it.
Yeah. And it's very, we have to consider Tituba's situation here. Not just is she being coerced or interrogated, but her status is markedly worse off than either of these other two women. And she may have very well have thought, the only way I can get out of this with even anything remotely close to my life or without, you know, like with my status as an enslaved woman, it might have been a self-preservation tactic to confess. Mm-hmm. In the hopes that it would get her off with a lesser sentence.
I mean, that's the issue with mm-hmm. confessions under duress.
Yeah.
Is you can never really know.
Mm-hmm. And confessions to not just her, but as we see this go on, we know that there's a rivalry in town. Mm-hmm. Who's mm-hmm. to say that these people aren't just like, oh, I don't like that woman.
Right.
She's a witch. And we talked about that last week, too, that when you have a guilty until proven innocent mindset instead of innocent until proven guilty... Mm-hmm. What is stopping you from making false accusations? Virginia put stuff in place to try and quell that, but like quell that, but like no such thing exists here.
Yeah.
So she does witness through all this, the signing of the book and everything, that she witnessed specifically dark magic, which is condemned in the, you know, Malleus Maleficarum.
It is hard to say.
Malleus Maleficarum. There we go. She claims that there are other witches working actively.
And that was like a big thing. We talked about it last week too. It was big thing was this belief of like covens and that there was not acting alone. And so they had to, it was almost like they were forced to identify other people that mm-hmm. were witches. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that were part of this coven with them.
Yes. Yeah. And not only does she admit to this existence of a coven and these other names mm-hmm. in the devil's book, but openly says they are working against the Puritans.
Yep.
It's no longer like, oh, they're working against good and evil. They're coming after you.
Mm-hmm.
You Puritans.
Mm-hmm.
Which, for a group who's got... I really hesitate to say this. I don't mean this in a bad way, but there is, because the life was very hard for mm-hmm. colonizers, but I don't have a ton of sympathy for colonizers because it's not your land.
Right.
But coming from a place where there's trying to purify a church and everything, there is a little bit of a victim complex going on.
Oh, for sure.
And so
for sure,
for them to be able
we
to say,
we were persecuted, we have to leave.
And yeah. now the witches are specifically after us, yes, Puritans. And
we've been punished, or we've been,
yeah,
yeah, whatever, again, targeted.
Which, yeah. again, is very dangerous when you have religions that believe yeah. in things like work righteousness. Right. And like, oh, you can work your way out right. of bad situations, or everything that yeah. happens is it's providence from God.
Yeah.
Because if something bad's happened, it's because you effed up.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So all of this, with Tituba's confession, begins the hysteria. It only worsens when all of a sudden upstanding members of society begin being accused. And we see things like this notably with people like Martha Corey, who was an upstanding member of the community and the church, like active member of the church,
mm-hmm.
And was very kind by all accounts. And when charges are levied against her, everyone gets paranoid and like turns on her.
Yeah. And that's what is really interesting about these witch trials, is like, it really is this kind of like this cultural like phenomenon
mm-hmm.
where it just seizes people mm-hmm. and
your friends are literally really willing to turn around and be like, oh yeah, yes, kill her.
Yeah. And that's how you end up with the case study I talked about last week with like 900 dead.
Mm-hmm.
It's like all of a sudden, you know, if you truly believe that the devil can get to anyone.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is how the devil
exactly
works.
That's exactly what happens yeah. here. Because yeah. they have this one prominent person. Because uh-huh. the others, unfortunately, uh-huh. an enslaved woman, an elderly right. woman, and a yeah. home, an unhoused woman.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, this isn't just a fringe society person mm-hmm. who doesn't fit the status quo and could be doing things for evil. This is a person they suspected of being a good person. They, right. they thought was a good person.
Right.
And if she can be a witch, who isn't?
Who isn't? Exactly. Mm-hmm.
And that also encourages these people uh-huh. to get a harder, like a harsher, like court evaluation uh-huh. because like they got to uh-huh. make an example. Like no one, uh-huh. not even the best of us uh-huh. can fool us.
Yeah.
We've got to make an example out of these good people who were actually bad the whole time.
Yeah.
And so you see this like really quick turn yeah. of just like people off 180 degrees all of a sudden. Eventually they bring in the big guns, notably the deputy governor of the colony, whose name was Thomas Danforth. And he starts cracking down hard enough that they start like pulling dozens of people from Salem and the surrounding areas to question them. He creates a special counsel whose job it is to basically just start putting people on trial from the surrounding areas. And the first to actually be put to death in the Salem witch trials was Bridget Bishop, who was hung on June 10th after she was brought to court with a reputation for, you know, gossiping and having a little fun maybe with some of the men in her community.
Mm-hmm.
And
who hasn't? Who hasn't?
Me. Unfortunately.
Hey, me neither.
But yeah, she continued her claim that she was completely innocent, but no one believes her, so she's found guilty and becomes the first one to be hung at what eventually would be called Gallows Hill. There is a notable discrepancy also I'd like to note. That was redundant. I said that twice. Notable note.
Hey, you're just emphasizing.
I really am.
Yeah.
Is
it notable, would you say?
Almost notable. Yeah.
Worthy of note, even?
Almost worthy of note. there is a discrepancy among how people see these proceedings. There are ministers and authority figures in the community, including the president of Harvard and his son, who advocate, they're the ones who advocated against the use of what they called like a spectral evidence eventually, which was basically dreams and visions and all of that. And I think you talked about that a little bit last week, that eventually they discredit,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
the stuff that you can't physically have any say in, like a fit or a seizure is yeah. more visible than like, oh, something, a ghost is pinching me.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
He's the one that said, it's better to let 10 witches be killed or yes. 10 witches live than one person, one innocent person die.
Mm-hmm.
He's that guy.
Okay. Yeah.
And Colton Mather himself, that's his name, would note, he was not against the witch trials, but he also wasn't all for them. And that's that really weird thing we see going on here with the authority figures. They can be like, oh, don't believe spectral evidence, but then attend a hanging the next day. Mm-hmm. Like, mm-hmm. it's very weird paranoia.
It is just like, to me, it's like a really interesting sociological thing.
And that's, that I happened. Think, really what a lot of the study of Salem witch trials is a psychological, sociological, anthropological anomaly.
Yeah.
But, and I think the anomaly comes from the fact that it's one of the most prominent in America, but mm-hmm. this is by no means an anomaly in Europe. No,
it happens, like, you see...
Like, thousands of
dead
in Europe.
It's not like there was... Yeah, there's not like there was one big, giant witch hunt in Europe where they just, like, march across the land and they get... It's like, it pops up, it bubbles up in mm-hmm. communities, and then they have a witch hunt that kills hundreds of people at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And then it just kind of dies out.
But this one is oddly, like, trying to be a court proceeding. It's trying to, like, hold to the standard that America likes to think of itself.
Right, yeah.
And it's also interesting, like, what did America think of itself so highly?
Right.
And... I mean, they're creating this whole identity around rights and due process and everything. Mm-hmm. And I mean, obviously, we're not yet to like the Bill of Rights or Constitution, but they have this idea of what they are. So they're trying to fit this really cruel and malicious and terrible set of ideals into their city of peace, their Salem, their Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, they're not able to reconcile these two things together.
Yeah.
So... A lot of this is also spurred by the Puritan belief that at the end of the day, your punishment comes from God. Mm-hmm. When you die, the real punishment is bestowed. Heaven, hell, everything in between, all that jazz. And it radically changes how their sense of martyrdom works in this community. Because, like, death is not uncommon in this time period. We have to consider how they feel about death. People are dying left and right. Smallpox, sickness, childbirth, like, tons of stuff.
Yeah.
So everyone's going to die. The real thing is... When you get to heaven, that's what matters. When you meet God at them pearly gates and he decides. So it's not so much like we're delivering justice. It's that we are sending them to go meet their justice, their permanent justice.
Right.
And it's very, we always have to consider how people view death in their societies when we're looking at this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
This committee that was putting everyone on trial was established by Governor William Phipps in May 27th of 1692. And he didn't have much give on the trial. Like, he was pretty strict-handed about the whole witch trials thing, about, like, convict, get rid of them, et cetera, et cetera. But he starts seeing some of these higher-up men, like the president of Harvard and his son, questioning this. And he's like, oh, well, I guess if the top people of society are saying something, maybe we need to, like, not be so cruel. Maybe I need to listen to them. And then his wife is accused and put under question. Big ol', like, I'm one of those guys, I don't care about it until it's my... daughter or my wife or my sister or something.
Or I'm above it somehow.
Yeah.
And then, oh, it's in my family.
But he formally removes the court of Oyer and Terminer, which is the name for that court that he had created, on October 29th, which right after my birthday, right before Halloween. I was like, that's why last week I was like, this is definitely an anniversary I will now be paying attention to. But, and that's not to say that with the removal of the court of Oyer and Terminer that they stop persecuting witches. He ends up replacing that court with something called the Superior Court of Judicature, which it's basically Court of Oyer and Terminer Light. Spectral evidence isn't allowed in this new court, but there are still 56 defendants brought forward, three of which are condemned. And even though Phipps eventually comes to his senses and starts pardoning everyone that was imprisoned for witchcraft by May of 1683, it doesn't change the fact that a lot of people have already died under these accusations. People had also died in their imprisonment. Jail was really a wooden building with incredibly inadequate facilities and hygienic, precautions.
Standards.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For standards. Easy to succumb to the elements or die from the conditions of living in your own filth, et cetera, et cetera.
Not to mention, again, this is Massachusetts.
Yes. You're chained to a wall. A wooden wall.
A wooden wall in Massachusetts.
You're gonna probably not make
it in the winter time.
You're not gonna make it.
No.
And it's also important to note that even the people who weren't killed, even the people who weren't convicted, it's obviously varying levels, but even those who were accused... You're ostracized.
Right.
You're suspected of it. Even if you aren't convicted of it, you're suspected of it.
Yeah.
And they face a lot of political stigma in the society. And those that were convicted usually had all their property taken from them, which means that you can't survive if you can't contribute to a community like this.
Yeah.
You can't get your own food. You have nothing to trade to others. You, like, there's no way to recover yourself in this standing.
Yeah.
And it destroys your sense of individualism and purpose, too. Like, if you can't be a contributing member of society because all of your stuff was
taken,
seized, like, what do you do? What is your purpose here?
Right.
Over the course of the entire trials, somewhere around 150 people received accusations of practicing witchcraft. Five of those accused of witchcraft died in jail or under interrogation of some sort. 19, as I saw, I think it's 19, died on Gallows Hill by hanging. A few animals were also killed, a couple dogs that were considered omens of evil. And Martha Corey's husband, the really upstanding lady who was first accused, like the first upstanding lady, her husband refused to appear in court at trial and was pressed to death in September.
Crap.
Which, if you don't know that practice, it's brutal. It is essentially, you're put under a plank and stones are added on top of you until it crushes you. It can be done very quickly. In Giles's case, it took 2 days.
Oh my God.
Which is incredibly brutal and disgusting. Like, that's
awful.
It's terrible. Your body eventually gives out.
Yeah.
But that puts the total of people who died as a result, either imprisonment, pressing, or hanging, around 25 when you combine all the men, women, and children. Which, compared to Cal's stats of thousands last week, it feels small, but and that's why I think a lot of this one, there are many events in history that have death tolls far higher, but this one is really a sociological marvel of why did this happen?
Yeah.
And if you look at those stats, you'll notice there's no burning at the stake in America. That's more of a European thing. Victims in New England were hanged, with the exception, obviously, of Giles Corey, and those who died in prison. Six of the people who were convicted and executed were men.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to note that because we sometimes talk about this as women.
Because out of 25 is what you said?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's actually pretty par for like the ratios there.
Yeah.
It was like 75% women.
We talked about that last week too, that there was a case study or two where statistically speaking, like rate of convicted versus men, like it varies, but it's kind of on par on course.
Yeah, that's pretty good. Or it's pretty, like, the percentage makes sense, like, around then. Yeah.
And the guilt around this is a pretty interesting thing, because over the next 2 years, almost immediately after, like, we see pardons being given and everything, we start to see people confessing to lying or falsely accusing people.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they were open about it in their lifetimes, and there's a lot of, like, I'm struck with thoughts of, like, Emmett Till.
Right.
And young men. Of minority cultures that were accused by white women.
Yeah.
And a lot of those women took it to a deathbed confession.
Yeah.
They did not admit this, or they left it in like a letter later in their life or something. But these people, oddly enough, were willing to come forward and say like, hey, I made a false accusation.
Yeah.
Which is really interesting to me.
That is really interesting.
I don't know if maybe the sin of lying was weighing on them so heavily that they felt they had to confess. I don't know what
that
was.
Or maybe they just knew that there wouldn't be any sort of repercussions for them.
Maybe.
Yeah.
That's very true. And you know, maybe it's there were so many people around them who also lied and falsely accused. It's like, you can't do anything to all of us.
Mm-hmm.
You can't get mad at me because my neighbor did this too.
Right.
Your reverend's daughter did this.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
There's a certain amount of, you know, what are you going to do about it? For a lot of people, though, it's far too late. They're already dead. And it's also, oh God, this is such a fascinating anthropological, sociological study, because it's important to note that people who were scared of being accused themselves, what's a surefire way to make sure that you don't lose your status and property and importance and relationships? You accuse someone else first.
Mm-hmm.
It could have been a defense mechanism.
That's such a good point.
Mm-hmm.
That is such a good point.
Mm-hmm. Because if I say Cal's a witch and all of a sudden Cal turns around and says, nope, Cass the witch, I'm going to be like, no, I said it first. Exactly. I said it first, bitch.
Yeah.
You're
sounds like someone who was a witch would say.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. I said it first.
Yeah.
So like, that's a good way to try and prevent anyone from, and if there's no repercussions for me making a false accusation, there's no risk.
No risk.
There's no risk.
No risk at all.
And so, and worse yet, you don't want to be sympathetic. You don't want to come off.
Oh yeah, that's like worse. That's like the even worse.
If Cal gets effused and everyone's like, "Cat, aren't you?"
Well,
friends?
even if I like am a judge and I'm like, "Guys, we maybe should not accept testimony under duress."
Yeah.
And people are like, "You're sympathizing with witches."
Uh huh.
And
then you get to, and then it's like, "Oh no, yeah, exactly."
Yeah.
If you as the judge,
uh-huh.
or me as a girl on the street, okay.
Yeah.
Hypothetical.
Yeah.
You are accused of witchcraft. You get carted off. And everyone's like, "Kat, weren't you friends with Cal?" And I'm gonna be like, no. In fact, Appa's a witch. I'm not a friend of witches.
Yeah.
Appa's a witch.
That's her familiar.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you're like, "No, I was never friends with her. I was under her spell."
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's the thing.
Uh-huh.
I can accuse someone
uh-huh.
to get out of looking sympathetic.
Yeah.
There is no reason not to just lie
right.
about everything
right.
in this situation. And I don't think I've ever seen a crucible that is so
yeah.
able, like, they can form this.
Yeah.
Like,
it was definitely
insane.
Like,
you're
it
almost
fed
motivated.
Into each
yeah.
other.
You're
yeah.
motivated to
yes.
lie and accuse people.
There is nothing holding you against. And that's like why.
Every man for himself, you got to accuse someone before
yeah.
someone accuses you.
Well, and then we see it like, we see these kind of waves of like this like weird kind of fervor that takes over people in like the social media age. And
mm-hmm.
it's not as potent as that, obviously.
The stakes aren't as high.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But when you have this like, everyone was isolated in
mm-hmm.
colonial times.
Right.
And so like when you have this like whole like fervor
mm-hmm.
that takes over a town and it like,
you've never had a unifying factor before.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden
yeah.
between your two warring towns, what
uh-huh.
can you all agree on? That
uh-huh.
we just suck.
Uh-huh. And I'm going to accuse you and you're going to accuse me and I'm going to accuse you and you're going to
And that family
me.
I hate over there and that
uh-huh.
big fancy town
uh-huh.
who's taking
that
all
I want
profits.
Their land and
uh-huh.
I want to buy their land for real cheap.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many motivating factors
yeah.
to get people. And,
uh-huh.
and all you have to do is throw yourself on the ground
uh-huh.
and shake a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. Or convince your kid to.
And heaven forbid you actually have some sort of mental health issues or
right.
physical disabilities. We
yeah.
talked about that last week too. Like, there are so many factors here.
Yeah.
We could go on and on and on
yeah.
and on about.
Yeah.
But the response to all of this is this sudden change of perception is that there's a declared day of fasting on January 14th of 1697.
Huh.
It's not that far. It's like 10 years later. And they're
right.
like, "Hey, we need a day of fasting to reflect on the horrors and tragedies of Salem and what happened here."
Mm-hmm.
And they encourage people to question what they've done.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, again, so interesting because,
that is
like,
really interesting.
Repercussions like wise, like,
well,
what are you going to do?
Like,
get rid of the whole town?
It's like what I've seen in Europe, too. It's like, everyone just kind of wakes up and was like, "That was weird.
Wow, what was that dream?
That
we
was
all,
crazy.
We all have a communal dream. What was that?"
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then they like move past it. And it's
yeah.
such a weird phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. And about
yeah.
5 years after that day of fasting,
yeah,
they had decided the trials themselves were unlawful.
Uh-huh.
Which like,
and then they do, and they do it themselves.
I
it's
know.
Not like someone
this is the same generation
later or like comes in.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was like, "Oh, you guys shouldn't have done that." It was them.
Which is really interesting. America, take note. You can hold yourself accountable.
Yeah.
Like within a lifetime
uh-huh.
of someone doing something bad.
Please, please, please.
Please. Some of the accused Salem witches are given a pardon by 1711. Some even received compensation to their families. It's not exactly justice.
Yeah.
But £600 doesn't bring back your family members, but mm-hmm. it does show in some way that Salem was like,
yeah,
willing to kind of own up to screwing up.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Which it's just so weird to me. But when it's fun to talk about like the causes, about what really
mm-hmm.
could have caused this hysteria. And when you're considering all these factors of self-preservation, of, you know, me before the community, like I have to accuse someone before they do. There's no repercussions.
Mm-hmm.
All of these things are in and of themselves enough of an explanation
yeah.
to understand
yes.
why people were faking fits.
And that's like, to me, you know, the whole theory about like maybe there was some sort of fungus in the dirt
mm-hmm.
or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I get people wanting to have that explanation because it's so...
It's tangible.
Yeah, it's a reason.
It's science.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And just to be clear, what Cal is talking about is this theory
yeah.
that ergot...
Yes.
It's ergot poisoning, which is it's the same stuff that LSD is derived from. It's a fungus, and it often is found in rye.
Yeah.
And they were eating rye that had been stored for a
yes.
long time that could have very well had
yeah.
it.
And, you know, maybe that was... Who knows? But, like... To me, it's interesting because we see, like, I talked about a long time ago, the dancing plague.
Yeah.
And, like, sometimes just people
weird
do
shit
weird shit.
Yeah.
because it's 1519 and there's what else are they doing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, yeah. And it's 100% like, and that's the weird thing. I mean, if we look, the reason that the whole ergot poisoning is so prominent is because the symptoms are literally like vomiting fits, feeling like something is crawling or pinching your skin, and, you know, which is exactly what those, these girls are claiming, yeah, with maybe, their hallucinations.
Maybe they did have
a couple.
Maybe a couple, and that's where it started.
Yeah.
And people, and when they don't spread. Have a reason and they're already kind of worked up.
Mm-hmm. But not every person making an accusation was displaying these fits.
No, it was, maybe it was like where it mm-hmm. started, and then it just like spiraled.
Yeah, it could also have been encephalitis, a venereal mm-hmm. disease, mm-hmm. some weird strain of another illness going around. Like, yeah. we don't know. And it would be so nice if we had like scientific answers. But at the end of the day, I don't think we actually need one.
No.
Because humanity accounts for what happened here.
Yeah,
like our weird societies account for this level of, I mean, society daily commits uh-huh. horrible things against each other. Uh-huh. What's to say that 25 people dead accused of witchcraft? It's uh-huh. not a stretch. It's really not.
I mean, I didn't think the drawing, I mean, it's not a direct comparison by any means, but talking about like the, how black men were accused of rape.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
A lot.
Birth of a Nation comes out and everyone's like, oh, we can all do this. Out
and people go to lynch mobs and have a party.
Yes.
And that is essentially...
That's kind of what
this is. The same kind of vein of behavior.
Yeah.
Of, like, this weird, like, thing that people get caught up in.
Yeah.
And it's awful. It's horrible. And people die and suffer.
And unfortunately, people never admit they're wrong on the whole lynching thing. Yeah. Because America really doesn't want to reconcile that part of history.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's like we see these patterns.
Mm-hmm.
And like, we recreate it and we explain them differently each time. But at the end of the day, humans don't need an excuse to hurt each other.
And
they do it all the time.
Exactly. And I think like a lot of the urge too is that like people are, we have been convinced by the Victorians, let's just say it, that history has been this one steady line towards progress.
Right.
And that how somehow we are more evolved than the humans that came 300-500 years before us. When in reality, we just have more technology and more access to knowledge.
And we're bearing the same systemic issues they did, some of which we have reconciled, some of which we have not.
Uh-huh. And so we are not... And people, I think, want to find concrete answers for stuff like Salem.
Yeah.
Because it's clean. Well, they must have, like, humans would never. Like,
it's clean and easy to tie up in a little bow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we understand that now, and it'll never happen again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this whole concept of Salem saying, like, hey, we're sorry we messed up is really interesting because this has been happening in Europe for hundreds of years at this point. Like, this is not, oh, Salem accidentally did this. And then they're like, oh, we just discovered something new. Sorry, we let it loose.
Yeah.
Our bad. Like, they knew full well what the implications
were. Well, and then think
of,
like, you know, these people come from Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Their parents lived in European witchcraft craze, like they have this kind of, even their grandparents,
the grandparents, great grandparents,
like they have this in them, they're primed to believe in something like this,
because what do you grow up believing? Whatever your parents tell you to believe,
exactly,
or your authority figure
and your culture tells you to believe.
And it's ingrained at this point, it exists, it's written into legal legal documents, the Malleus Maleficarum, like the second highest selling book in Europe at this time, like in the world, maybe even that tells you something about how this was a unquestionable fact of their life. They treated witchcraft that way. And that alters radically how common it will be perceived in society.
And then something I touch on in mine is, so this is 1690s when this happens, 1700s. What do we got?
It's my next bullet.
Yeah.
Enlightenment.
The Enlightenment.
Scientific revolution.
Yes.
Enlightenment.
Yeah.
And man, I'm so glad you said that. It's literally, I'm turning the
I believe
to show
you.
Look at that. Scientific revolution. Top line right there. It's about to come along. And while there are still plenty of people that have fear of witches and this paranoia, and I mean, the scientific revolution does not do away with religion or culture. In this way, like, it doesn't just remove it, but it provides an alternative answer to things. And it allows people for the first time to question their religions and what their parents told
interesting,
them.
Interesting, some of the articles I was reading about, like, why witchcraft died out when faced with the Enlightenment is that they for the first time, really, we're like, oh, we were just dumb.
Essentially.
Like, we didn't understand. And all of a sudden, it was in vogue to be science and not mystical.
To question things and ask, like, hey, is this ethical? Like, what are ethics?
Right.
Are ethics involved in religion?
Right.
Like, all of these big questions of also, like, can I question this reverend who I don't agree with? Do I have more than one church to choose from in town if I don't like that? Like, all of these things are huge factors. And all tentatively kind of actually step back here, and I'm about to hand you the reins, but I do want to note that specifically talking about Salem, you know, like I said, if you've been in a America public school, you've probably read The Crucible, which was an attempt to illustrate McCarthyism through kind of his allegory of like, again, you hear witch hunt all the time nowadays, especially in Donald Trump's vocabulary. I don't think he has ever read The Crucible, nor does he understand the implications of the play. There's some really, I do love reading theories about it, whether it's like ergot poisoning or, you know, something encephalitis related, whatever. But it's, over the last couple of decades, it's also both the play, but mostly the history of it has really become an example of intolerance, and just how dangerous it is to be caught up in this paranoia and hysteria of fear of things. And especially injustice towards women, and people now use Salem as a sort of destination, like a travel destination for tourism, but it's also a very important place to people who actually are Wiccan or practice some form of witchcraft, because for them it's a safe space, but also kind of a opportunity to visit a place where a big piece of history in their culture has existed. But that's also a huge Halloween, because of its promise of witches, it's a huge Halloween destination. I've always wanted to visit it just because of the historic significance, but if I got to go around Halloween time, I do think that would be like the coolest time to visit, just to see how it's perceived by the community and the public and everything.
It would be,
I've heard they go all out.
I heard they go all out, but I heard that that means that everyone
is
there.
I'm sure they're booked hotels months in advance. But I've also have a family friend who lived there a while, and the pictures of it in the fall were beautiful. But I do also want to note that while accusations of witchcraft may not take you to court anymore in America, there are still parts of the world where witchcraft and accusations are a very terrifying and real thing, especially in areas that face really high mortality rates because of disease and illness. Like, literally, there was a woman not too long ago who was burned alive because, well, she was accused of spreading HIV/AIDS, and that it was like witchcraft and that it was her doing everything. And like, so this is not by any means something that, like, as a topic I handle lightly, knowing that there are still people who face active issues for this, or active like persecution for this. And that's, I'm not saying that everything's fixed in America either. It's a religion like any other. And a lot of people face a lot of stigmas for it. Not until 1957 did Massachusetts formally apologize for the Salem witch trials, like, which is interesting because, like, that Salem itself kind of, like, apologized for it and, like, expressed that they were sorry and kind of tried to do some damage control. But Massachusetts formally recognizes it in 1957. And it was actually last year, in July, that Elizabeth Johnson Jr. was officially exonerated. She was one of the witches, or women, hanged for witchcraft accusations, I should say. For some reason, she'd been left out of the 1957 resolution that pardoned everyone else. I don't know if she, like, they forgot her name, or maybe they didn't have her on the original register or something, but it was actually the efforts of an eighth grade class of civic students that got her own pardon last year, so that, and that she, as the last convicted witch in Salem who hadn't received a pardon, finally did last year. And I think that's really interesting to see something happen so recently in history. Because you're like, oh, shit, there is no time limit on certain things. Like, there's some things you got to do no matter what point in history it is. So, I know I kind of jumped off at the scientific revolution there, but that'll bridge into yours pretty well.
That's good. I mean, recommendations. Good job. Yeah, good job. That's Salem. And it's funny because it's like, I've heard the story of Salem so much, but it's like, doesn't stick in my mind. So every time I hear it, I'm like, oh my gosh. Like, it's, you know, it's like I'm hearing it for the first time.
Well,
so
I could list you every name and everything, but that doesn't, all of it. Like, that's again, not the implications are not or the the like raw dates and numbers aren't always as important as the implications and how we understand it. So I didn't want to give you like a court stenographer's history of the trials, because we also don't have complete like transcriptions of every single trial. So, but that's the important, what I think are the important factors of the Salem witch trials, and hopefully you can kind of look at it with a critical lens.
Yeah.
And ask your own questions about it and see how it relates to now, because this is still something that is very relevant.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, good job.
Thank you.
Brava. Thank you. I said, yeah, recommendations. I have one.
I do too.
So I want to recommend the movie Paranorman.
Oh, yes. I love that movie.
It's so good. It's by Laika Studios, the same people who make Coraline and The Box Trolls and a bunch of other just gorgeous, gorgeous.
I did like Box Trolls.
Yeah.
It was fun.
I haven't met a Laika movie that I haven't liked.
They're kind of like fun and goofy. And just good times.
And I mean, just like the pure talent of stop motion animation is incredible to watch on its own.
Yeah.
So there's always that factor too. But Paranorman is basically like set in Salem, but they don't call it Salem. And it's, it, I watched it for the first time a couple of years ago and I really, really enjoy that movie. And yeah, that's what I recommend.
I love it.
Yeah.
Mine's a little more, unfortunately, boring and practical. for some of you, this is probably something you've been doing for months now, but here in the great state of Texas, we're just now getting our first cold front, and that's what made me realize it. Everyone, get your chapstick now.
Oh my God.
Because I woke up. I know. I woke up the first morning of the cold and I was like, where's my chapstick? And then I was like, oh no.
I just ran out of the. So I keep a tube in my bag for work.
I know. I like one in my desk, one in my bag, one in my purse.
And I ran out of my one in the house. And I'm like, oh no, I've got to go get that.
I know. Yeah. You've seen me. I use so much. Yeah. Kaylee makes fun of me for how I put on chapstick.
Well, I put it on the other day and it was like, you know how when it hasn't rained for a while and the water just seeps into the ground? Yes. I swear that's what happened with my lips. Like, it just, like...
The cracked earth just, was like, renewed. Like, osmosis. No, genuinely, that's why I was like, I'm going to warn people of this. Everyone else in the U.S. is probably our... Well, we don't just... We are grateful for our non-U.S. listeners, I would like to be clear.
Yes, yes.
But, like, for us down here, we haven't needed it yet. And so I'm... Lest you be caught unawares like me, get your chapstick. And also, make sure... You get good chapstick. There are some chapsticks that are not actually for like long-term health of your lips.
I have a fantastic, fantastic, best chapstick brand I've ever had.
Which one?
And like literally there's a person on TikTok and they review chapstick and they are like, this is the best chapstick.
Which one?
That you can like buy at a normal
store. Killing me.
Yeah, sorry. It's called Rebels Refinery. And my mom found a package of them at Marshall's once, and me and her, she was like, here, we can split these, because they were like skull shaped and they're kind of like EOS size. But oh my God, me and my mom were both like, this is really good chapstick.
It didn't leave your lips feeling more dried out.
No. Okay. Oh my God. It is. I literally have been thinking like, I'm going to order some more for the winter because I just ran out.
I'll look. And if they come in like a combo pack, I'll order those. Because I need good chapstick. I have the brand I'm okay so with, good. But I need a brand that I like before bed I put on.
Yes.
You know?
Like, oh my God. Me and my mom are both like, and we did everything we could to like, go get some more. It is such good chapstick.
Rebel Refinery. Yeah,
Rebels Refinery.
Rebels Refinery.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good to know. I'm all set now.
Yeah. Yeah. I was literally like, I was like, I need to do that. I need to look and get some. So that's what I would. There we go. I'll tack on to your recommendation.
I like it. I like
it.
Okay. Well, I'm going to jump into your side of things.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So as I mentioned before, I did the first half of kind of the European, an overview of the European witch craze and last episode. And this week I'm going to be doing kind of the coming down from the peak of it. And then also like the repercussions and the legacy and like blah, blah, blah of the witch trial craze. And I don't like to call it like. Sometimes it's referred to as like the burning years or something like that. I don't know. I like to call it like kind of like the witchcraft craze that happened in Europe because fun fact, while witches were burnt in Europe more often,
it wasn't the primary
mode.
That's what I thought.
And if they were burnt, most of the time they were strangled beforehand and like killed before they were put
and
on
like
the
burnt
pyre.
On a pyre.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Or the stake or whatever, because, or smoke inhalation would have gotten them. the first thing I kind of want to talk about, and I'm going to do a really brief kind of skim of this because this is really fascinating, and I do want to do a deep dive into this in a future episode. I wanted to talk about how witchcraft came to basically the UK, because for a long time, as Europe and specifically Germany and France were kind of in this moment, this cultural moment, it took a while for it to make it over to Scotland and England. And we can actually pretty much contribute the arrival of the witchcraft craze in Scotland to one person in particular. So, in 1590, there was a series of witch trials called the North Berwick Witch Trials. These were some of the first...
You said Berwick?
Berwick. B-E-R-W-I-C-K.
Huh. Okay.
These were kind of... There were witch trials in Scotland, but they weren't of note. This one's like the first one of note. Specifically, and I'm giving very, very, very loose details because I want to go into this later. Specifically, this one is of note because it caught the attention of the King of Scotland at the time, King James VI, who would be the future King James I of England. He gets involved because he has recently developed a fear that witches plan to kill him he was traveling to Denmark in order to get his new wife earlier that year, and storms hit him. And so he's like, witches are trying to kill me. And now there's this prominent trial and I'm going to get involved with it. And so when he comes back and he hears that these witch trials were happening, he was like, oh my gosh, he, has the suspects brought directly to him. And then he goes so far as to accuse a nobleman that he was a witch as well, the 5th Earl of Bothwell, Francis Stuart. And so he's directly wrapped up in this trial and he is thinking, oh my God, witches are going to get me and I'm going to be involved in this. And this leads him to write a book called Demonology in 1597 and publish it.
God, the word demonology is also just like such a
baller. I know. Especially when it's spelled like daemonology. Oh, yes. Yeah.
That's somehow so cool. I know. Probably means a lot of people died as a result to this, but dang it.
Well, he's not the first one to write a book called Demonology. He was just kind of following in that tradition.
Yeah.
But he's to have such a notable figure in the UK write a book on demonology. Oh my God. It brought that witchcraft craze to Scotland and England instantly, especially as he becomes the King of England. So with that, we see some of the first kind of really serious witch trials start later in England. The Pendle witch trials of 1612 are some of the most prominent in English history, which resulted in the death of 10 of the 11 people who were tried. But still, even in England, it seems like they aren't immune to the decline of the witchcraft craze that we start to see around 1630. Around 1630, and if you remember from last episode, the peak, as we like to call it, happens from about 1560 to 1660. So we're kind of rounding the corner on the peak here. We start to see in the 1630s, a reconsideration of legality and what the law can and can't do and what basically trials should be. And
what do you mean due process?
Exactly. So we start to see stuff like in 1635, the authorities of the Roman Inquisition acknowledged that its own trials, the Roman Inquisition, had, quote, been found or had found scarcely. Okay. Let me slow down. That its own trials had, quote, found scarcely one trial conducted legally. So again, we're kind of seeing people being willing to look back in their own lifetimes and be like, wait a minute, we aren't doing this right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we might have messed up a little.
Yeah. We might have gotten a little too overexcited. And so we see that kind of shift happening. Another shift we see happening is religious tensions ease. A big thing that a lot of people contribute to the spike and the height of the witchcraft trials is the Reformation itself.
Yeah, I've heard that yes, before.
Yes, because if the Reformation is happening in 1500 and you get the spike of the witchcraft craze pretty soon after that, it makes sense that like this sort of tension and this concern and this like kind of awareness about religion and what is proper religion and what is properly following God is kind of like super on people's minds, mm-hmm. you know? Yeah. We also see in the kind of decline, the period after 1630, we see the end to the 30 Years' War. And with that, we see a lot of resolution of, again, more religious tension throughout Europe.
Okay.
We also see the easing of the Little Ice Age, which if you remember from last episode,
yeah, that creates that a lot of tension when people creates a lot of, you know,
when there's
die.
No crops. Yeah. And in fact, the case study I talked about last episode was pretty much a direct cause of the Little Ice Age, was because they had a super late in season frost that killed all of the crops, and witches were blamed for it, and hundreds of people died. So as we approach the 1700s, we see the Little Ice Age kind of, we see temperatures warming back up, crops become more reliable, that anxiety is eased as well. We also, as I just mentioned, talking with Kat, we see mm-hmm. the beginning of the development of what we now call the Enlightenment and the Scientific Revolution. Yes. So we have moved through the Renaissance.
The Renaissance. I can only hear it like Concon history.
I was going to say like Philomena. Mm-hmm. So we are moving towards what's becoming more in vogue now is science and scientific process. Mm-hmm. And
it's cool to be smart. Now.
Yes. Yeah. And we are seeing kind of the encouragement of people to think about things logically instead of being caught up in, you know, a fervor or, you know, the hype of the moment. Yeah. And to, you know, even
almost one could say hysteria.
Yes. Even like, you know, not being able to believe in things unless you can scientifically prove them mm-hmm. is another big thing that's happening. And as we see ideas of the Enlightenment develop, they are permeating throughout culture. Right. It's not just like some scientists figuring out the scientific method. It's it like yeah. takes over culturally.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden it's cool now to be like, you know,
it's hip to be square. Yeah.
Exactly. So we don't see kind of the same like culture getting caught up in mm-hmm. and crazes anymore because yeah. that's falling out of vogue mm-hmm. and now the next new thing is
don't go with the flow, be logical. Your own person.
Yes.
Yeah.
And we also see as this tide turns many European countries beginning to actually issue laws that abolished the hunting of witches or just kind of abolish their laws that made witchcraft illegal in general. Mm-hmm. So basically all of this is that there was a lot happening from 1500 to 1700. And for whatever weird, bizarre reason, that meant that people were being accused of witchcraft.
Yeah. Because that's what we do here.
Yeah. And as those tensions all settled and people became more secure and living became easier and tensions were eased, we see that fall out of vogue. This is not true as a blanket statement. Obviously, Salem happens pretty late in the game, 1692. And we see this kind of on the kind of like the main continent of Europe is where this is all happening. And then as you get further out from the main continent itself, it takes a while for these ideas to reach people. So we see another witch trial, a significant witch trial happening pretty late in the game too in Sweden, where 71 people were killed in 1674 for witchcraft in a single day.
That's like on par with Salem. That's pretty late
yes,
for them.
Yeah. Then we also see the Salzburg witch trials in Austria, where 139 people were executed between 1675 and 1690. So we see this, we still see it existing and happening, but as the Enlightenment ideals, as culture kind of shifts and changes. And right now, like, where's that culture coming from? France.
Right.
Yeah. And that's mainland Europe.
France.
Yeah. So it's taking a while just to get
because it's the 1600s and ideas don't travel fast.
I don't know what you're talking about. I saw a TikTok from them just the other day.
Oh, well, you should have sent that one to me.
Sorry.
My bad. And then once we're in the 1700s, for sure, we see a drastic decline of what's happening here. It peters off in England pretty fast. We see, like, just for example, Jane Wyndham was one of the last subjects with a very stereotypical witch trial in England in 1712, but even she was pardoned after her conviction and set free. And the very last execution for witchcraft in England took place in 1716 when Mary Hicks and her daughter Elizabeth were hanged for witchcraft. In 1727, we see the last woman executed for witchcraft in Scotland. And then finally, in 1735, we see the Witchcraft Act basically was like, okay, witchcraft is not illegal. You guys can do whatever you want. We'll probably frown on you for it.
But we're not gonna hang you for that.
In other places, it takes a little bit longer. In Austria, it takes until 1768 to outlaw witch burning and torture. And in Switzerland, it takes even longer. We're moving further and further away. Because in 1782, she's actually one of, like, the latest proper witch trials as we see this. It's an interesting, because it's like, it's still a witch trial, but it's not technically a witch trial. It's like they're accusing her of being a witch, but they don't have the legal channels anymore to accuse her of being a witch. Mm. So they're getting as close as they can.
I don't have a reason, so I'm going to make it my own.
It's kind of like how sex workers back in the day were charged with, like, loitering, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Or no, vagrancy. Like,
it's,
yeah.
I'm going to tell my mic. Sorry if you hear a little bump. I'm having to lay down. My hips hurt. Yeah, no, like, coming up with an excuse, it's a lot of, like, early American Reconstruction.
Yeah.
Like, accusing African-American men of loitering while, like, you don't allow them to buy land.
Just kind,
like,
of whatever excuse, whatever will get them close enough.
We're going to put you in a position where this is,
the thing you're doing that we don't like is not explicitly illegal, so we're going to get as close as we can to that.
And we're going
to
put you in the position where it's very likely that you're going to be acting on that anyway.
So this happens in Sweden in 1782. A woman by the name of Anna Goldie was executed, in Glarus. Her official reason for execution was that she poisoned her employer, I guess. But the accusation was that, like, her employer believed that she had practiced witchcraft on his daughter. And so I guess he was like, she's poisoning my daughter. And I don't know, poisoning not me the daughter. Too, I guess. It's always the daughter.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, we've talked about this before.
Yeah.
Children are very easy to speak for because they usually aren't credited or able to speak for themselves. So, you know, how dare you touch my daughter? This happened to my daughter, my baby. This is like... Children are easily defensible because they need to be protected and they can't speak for themselves. So you can also manipulate children in that same vein.
Right. Yes, that is an excellent point. And what's interesting about this one, too, is even though she was tried and found guilty and executed for it, pretty quickly around Switzerland and Germany, like, people are like, that was uncalled for. And it was even considered, like, a judicial murder. Like, they were like, that was not, you should not have killed her for that. Like, there was no basis for that. Mm-hmm. So as we move further and further away from the height and the craze of the witchcraft era in England, we see the end of legal trials that have connection to witchcraft, and it becomes much more of a cultural thing. We see witch hunts turning from, they literally bring an inquisitor in and he's part of the government, to kind of vigilante justice, if you will. And unfortunately, a lot of people do die as a result of this. So we see kind of like civilians going on their own witch hunts and committing and killing women, not just women, but
because they think the civilians. Government won't protect us. We're going to do it ourselves. Yeah,
and I know that person's a witch, and we're going to go get him. So it was kind of like a mob style, you know, torch and pitchfork.
It kind of reminds me of that whole discussion about, like, when you make something legal, are you doing more for it, or are you actually hurting it? Because like the discussion around cannabis.
Yeah.
Like, if you can make it legal, you can dispense it safely and cleanly and make sure that you're using, like, clean strains and stuff like that. But if you make it illegal, it's harder to monitor, and it's done in backdoor alleys and stuff.
Yeah.
And, like, it's that same question. Like, well, if you make it legal, like, can you protect it?
Yeah.
But if you make it illegal, is it just, it's like that inverse of that.
Yeah. Well, especially if we're talking about something that has been in the European culture for one way or another for hundreds of years at this point.
Yeah.
And even though it's not technically illegal anymore to be a witch, it's still very much culturally not allowed. And these people, like we said, have been raised by their parents believing in witches, their grandparents, their great-grandparents, this whole lineage and this whole culture that for centuries was like, this is a real threat. And if the government's not going to protect us from it, we are. And so this leads to several kind of vigilante witch hunts happening, including one in England as late as 1836, where they killed a man that they believed was conducting witchcraft.
Wait, you said 36?
1863.
Okay, no, you're good.
I misspoke.
Good.
Yeah.
No, you're good. My brain has a hard time processing numbers. I genuinely thought
I for sure said 36, so that was my bad. So in 1895, and this doesn't end here, it just becomes less of a cultural thing and more of just like an accusation, like case by case thing. There was a woman named Bridget Clearly who was beaten and burned to death by her husband in Ireland because he essentially believed that she had been like a changeling and switched out that she had been replaced with a witch. And that to me seems more of like maybe there was something else going on there.
Yeah, that sounds. Yeah. Yeah.
But as we move into the 20th and the 21st centuries, as you mentioned, there are still very much instances where women are accused of being and die because people believe that they're a witch.
It's also interesting to me across cultural lines, like what does witchcraft look like and how does that affect like if there's like, like the idea of changelings, that something is essentially a clone. Mm-hmm. It's not like, oh, a familiar where there's a visible difference between like her and her cat or something like that. But like the inability to even trust that the person in front of you is the person you know, that creates a whole different level of hysteria. That's like a
really, really paranoia there. Yeah. So all in all, throughout the years, a lot of, and I wanted to talk about this because it's interesting to talk about historiography and how we, you know, interpret this period in our history. In 1784, a man by the name of Gottfried Christian Voigt.
That is a name.
Yeah. So let me back up. Voltaire. What a guy.
I like that. Hold on. Let me back up. Voltaire.
Voltaire apparently writes one of the first estimates on how many people died as a result of this witchcraft craze throughout Europe.
Okay.
His estimate, Voltaire's estimate, is several hundred thousand. Gottfried Christian Voigt in 1784 writes in response to Voltaire and is like, no, I think you're wrong. I think actually 9 million victims died as a result of this witchcraft.
I feel like that number is a little bit much.
Way goes off the rails.
Like, it might be more than, you know, Voltaire, but that seems like a notable, like, that at those levels, you've, like, reduced carbon emissions.
Yeah,
that's like
I know.
Genghis Khan
killing
so many people.
That is a significant portion of the population.
Yeah.
And you would know if 9 million
people
died.
I'm thinking, like, you'd see a huge, like, population drop after that. Like, and, like, if all these, specifically majority women are dead, you'd see a massive decrease in childbirth and, that seems a little too high for me.
Yeah. I wanted to mention that specifically, though, because for whatever reason, this seems to be a lasting figure in how many people were thought to have died during the witchcraft craze. Maybe because of how, like, the flashiness of the number, it's pretty eye-catching.
It is a very number.
Yeah. And it's just not accurate. Like, there's no evidence to support anything even touching that. Even several hundred thousand is an extremely high estimate.
Yeah.
But it was kind of like, I think I watched a YouTube video. Yeah. It was like, you know, myths about the witch trials. And it was like, millions of people died. And I was like, who believes that? But apparently it's like a myth. I've never heard that. But I wanted to specifically mention that.
I just feel like we'd see more, like, implications from that amount of people killed.
That is a insanely big number of people killed.
Like, that would alter more radically in how society could function.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Especially if we just come out of, like, the plague.
Yeah.
Not just, but the plague came around not long before this, and we saw massive cultural implications from that. I feel like we would see more of a marked cultural change, and, like, socio, like, anthro statistics would be different.
Yeah. Also, like, these people, they did honestly, in their own way, believe that they were doing this legally. So there's records of it. And there would have been a lot more records if there were 9 million people that died. Like, anyway, so as by the time we get to the 1800s, we start to, like, reassess, and we're more in the thousands number. And then by the time we get to the 70s, that's when we can kind of really take a step back and look. Okay, we think comfortably around 40,000 to 60,000 people died from being accused of witchcraft in Europe during
Sorry if my voice is far away. I'm rolled on my stomach petting your dog. But yeah, that sounds like a really big number, but more probable than 9 million.
Yes, yeah. It is still a really large number, and I'm not trying to negate the effect that that had, especially because, again, this happened and it would flare up in certain communities. So for those communities, it did radically affect them, but it just wasn't anything near the number of 9 million. As I mentioned earlier, there is a variety of ways that these people were executed. They were burnt, but that was not the most prominent by any means. Most of it was just hanging. There was also a lot of non-lethal, what's the word? Non-capital punishments that people faced. And this was just like imprisonment. They were exiled. They had fines. But, you know, a lot of them were still killed, and it was hanging or beheading, or, yes, they were burned at the stake, but it wasn't, you know, it wasn't, like, every single witch was burned at the stake.
Gotcha.
Yeah. What's interesting, too, is we see in the 70s a reemergence and a huge explosion of scholarly interest in the witchcraft craze in Europe. And this includes all disciplines, as we were talking about with Salem. Like, it is a cross-disciplinary issue, because you really need to take a lot of different views to understand exactly what happens here. Mm-hmm. And we already talked about sociology, anthropology, philosophy. But another really interesting is we see a peak in, or an interest in, people who are interested in the witch trials that are people who do criminology, or the philosophy of science, or legal history.
Mm-hmm.
And this is all kind of bubbling up because in the 70s, what else is happening with culture, specifically culture among people who were affected most by the witch trials?
My brain's not bridging this gap.
Second wave feminism.
Oh, yes.
So we see...
My brain was not even... That's a really good point.
Yeah. So we do see across all sorts of women's history in the 70s, a bigger peak in this, but specifically witchcraft, because it was really a way for feminists at the time, for better or for worse, to point to that and were like, look, we were persecuted just for being a woman, which is not true, of course. But it does lead to, like, a height in interest in not just academically, but also culturally. And we've kind of never let witches go after that. I mean, they were never fully gone. Like, obviously, What's the movie? Judy Garland.
Wizard of Oz.
Oh my God. Thank you.
Wizard of Oz.
I said a panic moment. How could I forget that?
Somewhere.
And that's, you know, 39. So they've never been out of the cultural zeitgeist, but we see this like really big boom in academic and cultural circles because of that. And now I want to talk about the legacy, specifically how we view
God. Sorry, Kitty is also wearing a fantastic Frankenstein sweater, though, so you have to forgive us our doggies.
So, as we mentioned before, last episode, there is a connection with Jewish people and witches and anti-Semitic tropes that were attributed to witches and all that stuff. I looked it up because I was like, that is a really great point, and I do want to talk about that. And it seems, in a really interesting way, they kind of fed into each other, the bad stereotypes that people had about witches and the bad stereotypes that people had about Jewish people kind of like existed in the same moment and for the same reason. And they fed and they kind of created this thing that ended up being very visually similar.
What year was... Oh, I won't check it. What year was The Merchant of Venice written again?
Oh, God, I don't know. Whenever Shakespeare was alive. Whenever I think
about anti-Semitism, my brain's literally like, Shakespeare, you asshole.
So, a lot of people point to the witch's black hat, a black pointed hat. And
1596, roughly. Just okay. So we have that. If you don't know about the absolute anti-Semitism in Merchant of Venice, you should go read it with that lens, and you're going to be like, oh, there it is.
Yeah.
But it's interesting that that takes place right when all this is happening.
Yeah. So one of like the most notable features that you can kind of connect Jewish people with witches is the iconic like pointed black hat. And the pointed black hat in around 1215, Jewish people were forced to wear, and this is part of, I always forget this term, but there was a lot of, throughout a lot of histories in different times and places, certain groups of people were forced to wear certain clothing to identify them as part of that group.
Yeah.
And Jewish people were, the Nazis were not the first ones to create this. Let's just say that. So in 1215, it became common practice. I don't.
Sorry, her dog is staring at the wall.
He
like,
literally is. He went over there to stand
and is walking closer to
he's
it.
He's getting closer. my good old man dog. Oh, whatever. So they were, Jewish people were made to wear a distinguished, very distinguished looking cone-shaped hat that made them visible as Jewish people. And so a lot of people are like, well, you know, since, you know, witches wear that hat, is there a connection there? Mm-hmm. And chances are there are. And this is not, this doesn't end in 1215. In 1431, Hungary requires those accused of witchcraft and sorcery to wear, quote, peaked Jew caps. So they are directly saying, you have to wear those hats too. And then we also see this idea of the witch's Sabbath, which is, you know, a time every...
The Sabbath is
a Jewish tradition.
Well, it's religious in general, because Christians and...
Christians have a Sabbath.
It's pointedly
But the word Sabbath is mostly associated with the Jewish religion. Yeah. And basically the article I was reading was saying that, like, any sort of non-Christian gathering was seen as a Sabbath. Because of Jewish people and when they gathered.
Gotcha.
So this like became the witch's Sabbath, which further reinforced the connection between witches and Jewish people.
I'm switching my mic again, sorry if this makes it really
Even in the very early days of this witchcraft craze, we see the term synagogue used to refer to a meeting place of any kind with heretical communion.
Interesting. Heretical communion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Huh. Yeah. Oh, that's... Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay, that's interesting.
So, and even though that is very quickly replaced with, in favor of the term Sabbath, the origins of the word still connect it with Jewish religion and faith. We also see Jewish people regularly depicted with physical features associated with what witches might have in, from the devil, mm-hmm. such as clawed feet, talons, and horns. And then what is most fascinating to me is the idea that Jewish people, this is a time when medical science is, of course, not developed at all, and we are still dealing with the theory of the four humors and the temperaments, and, you know, women were, what is it, like, wet and cold, and oh men were, God. Like, hot and dry or whatever.
Oh, my God.
But
I forgot about that.
Jewish people and women were both had the same humors, were thought to have the same humors. And the Malleus Maleficarum itself cites women's humors that they have as the reason why they are more weak-willed to the devil.
Interesting.
So if Jewish people and women are the weak-willed same. And yeah. the same, because we think they have the same humor and temperament, then they inherently are susceptible to the devil. So this is why I kind of say that, like, the stereotypes between Jewish people and witches kind of develop together.
Yeah.
And they're kind of seen as,
you know. It's like parallel, they're parallel progress.
Yeah. And I'm not saying that, like, people thought that Jewish people were witches. That's not true. But they were seen as kind of the same group.
The same attributes. Yes. Same. Yeah.
Yeah.
Correlations and causes. We talk about that a lot.
It's really interesting. Another theory about, like, the witch's black hat could be also because of the Quakers, from the Quakers.
Mm-hmm.
Quakers were seen as, like, incredibly radical because they, for what they were very, very equal when it came to genders and what they thought the genders could do. And apparently in a woman by the name Amelia Mott Gunmer, who herself was a Quaker, writes a book called The Quaker, A Study in Costume in 1901. And she notes that 17th century preaching women faced witchcraft persecutions, wore pointed hats with aprons and high-heeled shoes. And so what does that sound like? That sounds like a witch.
Mm-hmm.
But this is still has this connection to Jewish people, because Quakers and Jewish people kind of were like allies in this, like, you know, being accepted by mainstream Christianity. Mm-hmm. And even so, like, Quakers supported Jewish resettlement, and, like, wanted to encourage Jewish people to exist in America. So they had this, like, kind of allyship. So we even see this, like, interesting connection with, quote-unquote, witchcraft and Jewish people, like, going into kind of the modern era. It's just, it's really interesting.
That is, yeah.
So the hooked nose, too, that we associated with a lot of, like, stereotypes about Jewish people, unfortunately, does not seem to be historic. Actually, what I saw was basically, like, yeah, Wizard of Oz did that for witches.
Really?
Yes. Yeah.
Really?
And maybe it is because of this legacy of
what year did Wizard of Oz come out?
39.
Oh.
Mm.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. And we still see Jewish people and witchcraft.
Well, I'm thinking, like
connected in every, this really, like, interesting way.
Grimm's fairy tales, like all the stuff that paints villains, not necessarily witches, but villains as, like, coded or, like, stereotypically showing features that were associated with Judaism. Like, like, how many times was it just like, oh, not necessarily witch, but the villain is portrayed as Jewish, and then how does that bleed over into witches are villains, so witches therefore are
Jewish,
right? Like,
or they must be. Yeah, it's just so,
like, because that, you're right, it's all developing at the same time. But, like, there is something very odd about the fact that the first time we see, like, the hooked nose like stereotype show up,
it's when
in film is a film witch that comes out during some
in 1939
some really nasty anti-Semitism.
That's, and that's the villain,
and that's
of, like, the story.
And are we looking at, is the witch portrayed as stereotypically Jewish because she's a villain, or because she's a witch,
right?
And is that causation or correlation?
I know. And now we read, because of Wizard of Oz, we read her as, that's a witch.
Yes. And that became representative.
The green skin, everything, that is what we now see as a witch. What did audiences in 39 think?
That it was a new Yeah.
Did they think, did they think that's a Jewish woman?
Yeah. Like, that's...
Yeah.
The implications of that are insane.
I
know.
And I, when I, like, I was reading this article, because I was fully expecting it to be like, well, in 1326, this person said Jewish people are evil and they're witches. And this is why
it's never
them. Yeah.
And that, well, and that's what's scary about things like anti-Semitism and racism is never, well, not never, but it is much less commonly outright said than created and injected into our society until it is a systemic thing. Because now how do we picture every witch? Mm-hmm. A green woman in a pointed hat on a broom, usually with a large bridge on her nose.
Yeah.
How many of those things can be traced back inadvertently to racist origins? Whether or not it was the intention, it's there.
Right. So, and like, the green skin idea comes from The Wizard of Oz too. And there's actually, history.com had a really good article about like every kind of one of the stereotypes that we associate with witches. I didn't go into detail with all of them. I kind of just stuck to like the ones that were relevant to the anti-Semitism discussion. But if you're interested and want to learn more, you can go read that article. I would recommend it. There's also a really great article. I just Googled like anti-Semitism and like witch stereotypes or something. Mm-hmm. And I forget what the name of the article was, but it was like the first one that came up. So, and it was really well written. And I'm sure there's a lot of really great resources out there if you're more interested in this topic. But to like wrap up, as you mentioned, the relationship that culture and society has with women has changed drastically from the early modern era to the modern era. In that time, we see the shift of perceiving women as kind of the aggressor sexually and the corrupter sexually, and that men were like the virtuous ones that need to be protected too. And this is, I'm putting this very like blanket statement. Generally, it's never that cut and dry. Two, women being the ones who are need to be protected. And we also see a shift of women are it's not even a shift, it's more of like a through line. Like, we have this idea that women are easily corrupted and that makes them evil in early modern and medieval times, to women are easily corrupted and that makes them pure and good and we need to protect them.
So we have to,
in modern times.
Well, and that also encourages, I there's a lot of discussion about this right now in the dating sphere of like conditioning when you like an older grooming like you have to get to a woman before she's corrupted and it is your duty to protect that and raise her into what you think a woman should be.
Well, and then think about, I mean, slut shaming and all of that, like, if you know, oh, she's worthless,
and we use
now
that term with utmost respect.
Yes, we do.
But like, it's that whole thing, like, at what point is a woman too corrupted for you to consider her worth saving?
I know.
And why?
And this idea of like women are like pure did not exist but in the past, but it's like the logic is the same, but they just are, have approached a different, like,
and how does religion affect that of being inherently
it's
sinful?
Just, it's so like, fascinating seeing how people's perception of women have changed, because I don't know, to me, like, it's really the Victorians' fault. Everything's the Victorians' fault.
Everything is.
Who
ate the mummies?
The Victorians. But like, how history is taught, at least in my education, up until maybe high school when you can have more nuance, is that like, you know, women were repressed and everyone was treated like a Victorian woman all throughout all history, and this is how women were perceived and blah blah blah, and then the first wave feminism happened, we got the right to vote, and then all of a sudden we're here now,
and that's just fixed.
Like, yeah, and it's not true. That's such a more nuanced and delicate and complicated conversation, and it's so fascinating to me because it's like, what were you guys thinking? I just want to get in your brains. When you, I just want to get in there.
And that's all those things that we're talking about right now are not, we're about to get really meta here. That's European, Eurocentric women.
Yes.
That does not even account for hundreds of cultures.
Yes.
The other, like, completely geographic differences. Like, the nuances we are talking about are European.
Yes.
There's so much more to be said about every other culture. Yeah. And, like, it's, and that's why people spend their whole lives studying this stuff, talking about this stuff, because you'll never understand it all. You can never have time to talk about it all.
No. And so that's kind of where I want to leave it, too. It's just kind of like, I don't think, because this lasted for so long, and because of then the eventual influence that, unfortunately, European nations would have on the world, I don't think we fully understand how the witchcraft craze affects us to this day. How this idea that women are weak and susceptible to influence.
Yeah.
And we still very much have those ideas in our society to this day. And it's just really fascinating to think about, like, is this where those ideas came from? Is this why women aren't taken as seriously?
Mm-hmm.
Is this why women have to fight twice as hard? Like, is this why, you know, it's so...
How far back did this put us in progress?
Right. I know. And it's just, we'll never know because we'll never live in a world without it. But
yeah,
it's just something to think about. And that's kind of where...
It makes me kind of wish that the multiverse, whether or not you believe the multiverse theory is real, what happens in the multiverse where none of that ever happened?
That didn't happen. Yeah.
Like, everything's exactly the same up until that point. Mm-hmm. What does it look like?
Yeah. So, it's anyway... Crazy. That is kind of the end of European witchcraft craze.
You did a great job with that.
Thank you. It was fun to research. It's a wild topic.
I think I really learned a lot.
Yeah.
I learned a lot.
Yeah. Because it's like one of those things where you're like, oh, yeah, I know about that.
We know the stories.
Yeah.
Understanding the stories is always different. And I know it's one thing to talk about, oh, yeah, I understand why the witches accused each other. Why people were. But to be able to sit here and talk about every nuance of why did they.
And really, like, think about it. Uh-huh. And be like, wait, wait, wait. And then they could be doing, and for this, and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just think it's helpful to sit down and hash out these topics. So it makes me realize that even if there's topics that we feel like we know, maybe we need to be talking about the ones we do know more, because we can feed off of each other. And
those are hard
to
pick too, because we're like, we don't need to do that one. Everyone knows that one. But there's a lot to talk about.
There is. And the problem is too, that ones we already know, we come at with our with our built-in biases and what we have learned previously.
And hey, maybe, you know, it's good that we do this, because we might learn something that changes our opinion on that. Yeah. So anyway.
So we'll look into some of those, honestly. Yeah. Maybe that should be a theme. Things we thought we knew.
Oh, that's a good one. That's a good one.
We do have a theme coming. Well, we just finished.
We just finished a two-week.
We might.
We're gonna probably skip the 145 theme.
Yeah, we might just have to.
But don't worry, because 150.
It's a history whodunit. A history mystery.
A very special, very special history mystery, and that will be coming at you soon. But until then, we hope you learned something.
Yes. And you can tell us by tweeting at us or Xing at us. I refuse to call it X right now.
No.
Also, I know a lot of people are actively boycotting Twitter as well, because Tesla has said some things that... Yes. But if you wanted to tweet at us and you are using the platform right now, TINAHL podcast.
Or you can email us at thisisnotahistorylecture@gmail.com.
Any review you leave is a super big help. We appreciate it. And every review that you do leave is one more reason for me to take the dog that I might be adopting. We don't know. We'll update you on that in a week or so. It depends on if I'm allowed to have a dog in my apartment. We'll see. But I guess that's all we have on the docket for today. And I hope you learned something, because I just want you to remember that this has not been
a history
lecture. Bye.